Okay, our second case this morning is 23-1262, Crum v. Chubb Limited. Now you may begin.
Good morning. My name is Carl Cicere. I represent Mark Crum, the appellant in this case. I'm going to endeavor to reserve 6 months for rebuttal, which will be handled by Mr. Crum. This case concerns the dismissal of four different categories of claims relating to Mr. Crum's flooding of his one-of-a-kind ski home in Beaver Creek, the world's greatest ski lodge, on Christmas of 2019. I plan on discussing the claims themselves and not the discovery-related challenge that we raise. In this case, although I'm happy to talk about anything, the court wishes to hear an argument on. I'd like to start with the first category of claims we raised in our brief, the FRV, or fair rental value, claim. Now, the court denied that claim on the basis that Crum hadn't established that he usually rented the property in the period immediately preceding his cover's loss. Now, putting aside the fact that the court actually cited the wrong provision of the policy when it reached that conclusion, there is a provision of the policy that does involve usually renting, and we think that the court's conclusion cannot be sustained on the evidence in this case. This home was a home that Crum bought and renovated and spent millions of dollars to rent it out to other people. It's rented out.
But his rental, I mean, he had only had a handful of rentals in 5 years, isn't that right?
He had 99 days of rentals in the 9 years he'd owned it. There's a period of 4 years in which he was not able to rent out the property.
So that leaves you 5 years, 99 days. How imminent had been the rentals? Had he been renting just before the water damage, or when was the last rental?
Well, he had actually gotten an inquiry and a commitment to rent the property right before.
I'm not asking about inquiries. When was the last rental, actual rental, compared to when the water damage occurred?
It was 4 years before, but he did have a commitment to rent it in March of 2020. So the rental period hadn't happened, but he had a commitment to rent it out in that period of time. So we think that counts as usually renting as well.
Was that in the record that he actually had a commitment?
Yeah,
that's a few months later, or just that he'd had an inquiry, or he was taking inquiries.
They had not assigned a rental agreement. Yeah,
there was
but
no
he said, "I'm going to rent this property. I've reserved it," and then that's at volume 14, 2468-70. And more to the point, though.
So is even assuming that's the case and it was to be rented in March, how does that come within the definition of the word usually?
Well,
it would be rented once in four plus years.
We've got two words, and I think both are important. The rented means either to have actual rental transactions or to be offered for rent. That's what hotels do. Even when their rooms are empty, they're renting rooms. That's what a motel does. That's what a B&B does.
Well, that's the difference between renting and rented.
Well, they're both I'm not going to be
rented a room is a historic fact. I am renting is a process, but not an history. I see a difference in meaning, but go on. That's not.
Well, I think it is looking backwards.
How many days were you claiming? What were you asking FRV for? How many days?
Well, the policy limit is 15 days, and we think there's at least evidence of 15 days, although we ultimately think that that's a determination for the jury, because he had offered the property for rent for 15 days. But at the very
times,
least...
Times 20,000?
Yeah. But for the very least, we think that the jury could conclude that an average of nine days a year for 9 years should equate to at least 9 days of FRV, and I think that's a determination for the jury to make. We also think that, like I said, there are two words, renting and usually means, and I think we all agree, under normal circumstances, so we should at least consider what normal circumstances are and include within the scope of a review of what usually rented means the entire transaction history. What is his normal circumstances for his rentals, and what are the abnormal circumstances? We'd submit the 4 years before the cover loss were abnormal circumstances because there was a once in a decade snow loss that depressed not only the rentals in the 2017 to 2018 year, but also depressed rentals in the 2018-2019 year because they didn't know if the snow was going to come back. You never know what's going to happen. And that takes us right into 2019 where that's when Mr. Crum's rental history usually begins. He usually starts to rent the property in the period after Christmas, and that's exactly what we would have had.
Was 2019, 2020 a good snow year?
I don't recall. I mean, offhand. But he had someone who was willing to rent it for two separate occasions during that period. Moving on to the ELE claim, that is the extra living expenses claim. Now, the district court's rejection of that claim was also unfounded because GNIC denied nine different claims for ELE benefits from Crum, and each one of those was a breach of contract and a breach of the duty of good faith.
And those were basically, I was a little confused on that. He says, I want to rent this house, and then Chubb said no, or, you know, where was he staying? He was staying at the Ritz, or I mean, what's going on?
He was staying in a portion of the property in which they didn't have a functioning kitchen, the kind of part of the owner's quarters, but it was very damaged, so he obviously needed to move on. He found a series of four rentals that he proposed before January 27th. For each of those, they said we're looking at them, we're reviewing them, we'll get back to you on them, and then never did. We get to January the 17th, and after that, he makes a series of accommodations. And by the way, for each one of these, he's contacted the property owner. He has inquired and negotiated a special rate and special dates for the property in the period. And after January 2017, they put him off. They say, well, now we haven't established your usual vacation occupancy of the home, a requirement that's only in the policy because the brokers probably erroneously put him in a vacation policy rather than a true homeowner's policy.
Was that accidental? I thought he said, I want a cheaper premium, and that was the only way they could get a cheaper premium for him.
Well, they promised that they could get the same coverage, and the only thing that he was trying to avoid was a construction surcharge. So they said, we can get you the same coverage with a lower construction surcharge, and that's why he went from his Chartist policy to his GNIC policy. And I'd like to just briefly get onto the broker's claim, because I think it's worth getting into as well. The essence of the court's denial of that claim was its conclusion that he had not established causation. The conclusion was really circular. The court says, well, he can't establish that he exceeded the policy's limits because he didn't establish he was entitled to coverage under the policy. Of course, we think he did establish he was entitled to coverage under the policy, but it's both the limits of the policy, that is the 15 days limits on FRV and the 60 days supposed limitation on ELE coverage, those limits, as well as the preconditions on coverage, like establishing usual vacation occupancy or establishing that he usually rented, we think those were both in violation of his express instructions to get maximum unlimited ELE and FRV with no exceptions.
I'm a little confused about that argument. I guess if we disagree with you that the extra living expenses, the ELE, or the rental, fair rental value, if we disagree and we think that it was paid, then what's left? Because why would there be any claim against the brokers that they should have gotten him an even greater maximum if he didn't have any, he couldn't even have met the maximum that he had?
Well, he would have had these claims. I mean, in terms of causation, the broker's negligence prevented him from being put in a policy that wouldn't have required him to establish his usual vacation occupancy, so he would have had coverage. The broker's negligence put him in a policy that made him require that he had to establish that he usually rented it in order to get any FRB coverage. That was something that was not in the Chartist policy. So our contention is that the negligence is in not putting him in a policy that would have created the conditions whereby it would have been denied.
Or as to living expenses, put him in a policy where he didn't have to prove expenses to get the maximum recovery, which is your argument, right?
Well, I mean, within the policy itself doesn't require that the losses be incurred. And that's not that they, that's not that
well,
he doesn't
that's
have to experience
argument.
These expenses. It's, he has to have a covered loss, and he has to have a need for the expenses, but that he has to, but incur is not a requirement in the policy.
Reasonable increase in your normal living expenses is what's
Right.
An increase in your normal living expenses.
And why would you
how would you not have to incur those expenses to have a reasonable increase in expenses?
Well, he would have had those increases if they had not been denied. And I think that ultimately goes to the bad faith of the insurers and the policy. They imposed a condition. You have to get approval from us on whether you're going to get a property. They deny approval.
Did they ever deny any living expenses?
They denied 9 different requests for living expenses.
They denied them or they just didn't? Where's the denials in the record?
Well, I mean, they never got back to him on any of the 4.
Right, there was no denial.
I would consider a delay of indefinite duration on a time, you know, when you have a time requirement.
Well, when he submitted the receipts from the writs, they reimbursed him for that, didn't they?
They only for that one, with that run rental, yes. But for the others, they completely denied.
What other expenses or receipts did he submit that he wasn't paid for?
There were no other. He decided not to take those used vacation.
So problems. He wants $4 million more, but he only submitted the $22,000 receipt for the Ritz-Carlton.
That's correct. And that's either because of bad faith, which denied him the benefits he was entitled to, the benefit of his bargain, or because of anticipatory repudiation. They decided they weren't going to, they declared to him that they were not going to honor their obligations in the policy, and that excuses him of his obligations. He should get the benefit of the bargain, the expenses that he would have incurred, but for their interference, but for their repudiation, and that he was entitled to under the policy. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal if I could.
Thank you. Right, for the appellee, Mr. Palmieri. Mr. Hacker, you're on first.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. John Hacker for Great Northern. I'm going to try to reserve 2 to 3 minutes for my colleague, Mr. Palmieri, who will argue the broker's issues on behalf of the brokers. After Mark Crum's vacation house was damaged by a sprinkler malfunction on Christmas Eve 2019, Great Northern immediately came on site, investigated, and timely paid more than $4 million to repair or replace damaged areas of the house and its contents. And immediately, upon the conclusion of a normal, contractually contemplated appraisal of damage to the home theater system, Great Northern promptly paid an additional $1.2 million to repair that damage as well. The principal issue here, as we've heard this morning, is whether Mr. Crum is also entitled to reimbursement for the fair rental value of a vacation house he had not rented for years, and for the cost of alternative housing he never paid for or lived in. And he also contends he should have been allowed to try his bad faith claims before a jury. None of his claims has merit. I'll start where my colleague started, my friend started, with the additional living expenses claim concerning the fair rental value of the home. That provision provides that if a covered loss makes a part of your house or other permanent structure, which you usually rent to others, uninhabitable, we cover its fair rental value during the period of time it is usually rented, for a reasonable period of time or up to 15 days. So he has to prove, to invoke that coverage properly, that his house is usually rented to others, and he has to show the period of time it is usually rented. And he didn't show that his house was usually rented to others, as we've already heard this morning. It had not been rented to anybody since December, January of 2015 and 16. So it was for 4 years without renting at all. And by no common understanding of the phrase usually rented is never renting it.
Do you agree, though, that if there is a episodal reason why you're not renting, you're remodeling the house, that period wouldn't count against your effort to show usual rental?
I don't know if I can answer that in a categorical way. I mean, if you choose not to rent for years because it takes you years to remodel the house, then it's not in that period of a house that you're usually renting. But I'm not taking issue with the 1 year in 2010 and 11 when he didn't rent. That's not really part of the calculus. The point here is that for 4 years, for various reasons, he didn't rent. It just wasn't a house that was usually rented. He blames bad snowfall in 1 year as a reason, but in the year immediately prior, in the year to the rental period, the year before this supposedly bad year of snowfall, he wasn't renting either.
If there had been just a 2-year gap instead of a 4-year gap, is that usual enough?
You know, there's going to be edge cases, Your Honor. I don't know, a two-year gap, and if we show a really consistent pattern for a long time and for 2 years, and there's some sort of understandable reason it doesn't look like it was a choice by him not to rent, one can imagine a different outcome. I'm not committing to that, but that's not the facts we have.
Why isn't that a fact question for the jury that would, you know, look at his reasons for the
non-rentals? Right, I'm agreeing at some point, you know, the facts can look, I mean, somebody could reasonably conclude that a period of time is usually rented. And I want to emphasize, it's not just a temporal dimension, it's the regularity, right? And both are missing here. You don't have 4 years, and you don't have any regular, you know, over that period of time. So if it's, you know, 1 year, 2 years, within a four-year period, that's just a different inquiry. And so it's just because it involves facts doesn't mean it gets to a jury, because the question is whether a reasonable jury can conclude that not renting it at all for four consecutive years qualifies as usually renting to others.
Do you think, I was surprised by his argument that because the snowfall was bad, that gives me an out. I didn't see anything in the contract that said that. I think the contract says usually rented, and you can have a reason for your own house why there might be an exception, but you can't simply say, well, the snowfall was bad, because there's no force majeure, or this would be something quite a lot short of force majeure in any event.
I completely agree. It says usually rented, which has the temporal and regularity.
But it doesn't have an exception for bad snow or bad
weather. No, that's completely right. The only thing I might concede in that area is if there is, like, you know, it's not usually rented because 1 year, for example, because of COVID, he just literally couldn't. It was like prohibited renting. You know, there's a government order. It just was absolutely zero market whatsoever, you know, for 1 year. That might actually kind of fill the gap in a regularity element. If you've been going year after year, and then 1 year, you just can't do it, but you tried to, and, you know, your bars were doing it. Okay. Maybe that's still usually renting it. But here we've got 4 years with 1 year of bad snowfall. And just other years where there's no explanation other than the fact of just descriptively undisputed that he wasn't renting it at all.
What's the explanation? Just moving to the incurring. What's the explanation for the Great Northern's denial of the substitute properties to live in?
So the district court said there were two reasons for granting summary judgment. One was that he hadn't actually incurred any of the, there was no reasonable increase. It just didn't exist. But the other one, remember, was that the denials were not improper. And when you look at the record throughout January, counsel's just incorrect in saying that Great Northern didn't explain. What was going on was Crum was demanding that Great Northern approve rentals for a year, 300 days, at $20,000 a night. And then at one point he negotiates one of them down to $5,000 a night for a year-long rental. And they're demanding a year-long commitment. And what Great Northern's claims adjuster says on January 2nd, as reiterated in the reservation of rights letter on January 17th, is we're still trying to figure out your usual vacation occupancy. And we don't have any evidence so far that would support the idea that your usual vacation occupancy is every day for an entire year or every day for 300 days. So we can't approve these exorbitant, you know, incredibly luxurious rentals, which are dependent upon the long-term lease. That's what they say on January 17th. They explicitly explain that on January 17th as to why they haven't been able to sign off on the requests, you know, before that date. And then that same thing, that same dynamic is continuing, where they're trying to establish or investigating to determine what his usual occupancy is. And it's not until middle March, March 27th, when they say, okay, look, we agree based on the documentation you've submitted that your usual vacation occupancy is at least 60 days. But all that period in January, February, March.
When was that agreement reached? What date did you say? March?
March 27th is the date they have a meeting with all the relevant people, and it's reported at the meeting. It's recorded in an email on March 29th that they have told Crum that they agree that his usual that he has established usual vacation occupancy. And if you just look at the literally day, you know, hour by hour, day to day communications and email responses, that's what they're trying to determine. And that's always the reason that they're not. Now, I want to clarify one thing that counsel said, which is Great Northern didn't demand the right to approve in advance and prohibit him from getting these other contracts, these other leases, if he wanted to. Great Northern was just saying, you know, we're not in a position to approve it because we haven't established your usual vacation occupancy. I don't want to get in a fight on the semantics of whether that constitutes a denial, because it is true that Great Northern wasn't agreeing that he should go ahead and sign a leave and that Great Northern would cover it, because if Great Northern agrees to cover it, they can't agree to cover it until they've established his usual vacation occupancy. So they're not agreeing to cover, but there's not any sense in which they're prohibiting him from entering a lease and incurring these expenses and then submitting them and establishing that, well, here's the period of time during my usual vacation occupancy, which I incurred the reasonable increase in living expenses, and, you know, I want you to cover them. That's how this should have worked. That's how it was.
Do you agree that he only made one explicit request for living expenses backed up by a bill that he paid?
Well, for alternative housing, yes, he had $22,000 that was paid when he stayed at the Ritz. In the brief, they keep referring it to as like a temporary hotel, like it's a, you know, Bob's Hotel down the street. It's the Ritz-Carlton Bachelor Gulch, Your Honors. That's where he stayed. And we kept saying to him throughout January, please go stay at the Ritz-Carlton Bachelor Gulch, you know, so the demolition can proceed on the house and all that. And, you know, he didn't do it. We approved 13-day stay at the Ritz-Carlton Bachelor Gulch in Beaver Creek, not far from his home. And unfortunately, it's right, you know, as COVID hits and then the hotel closes. But that's what we're offering, and we actually paid when he did stay for 7 days at the Ritz-Carlton Bachelor Gulch. We paid it. Now, we also paid all kinds of additional living expenses in terms of food and housing for his dog, because they correctly say the part of the house he was living in didn't have a functioning kitchen, so we paid for very generous food expenses. He has no complaint with that. He has no complaint with the $4 million and then $5 million.
Well, they argue it's bad faith to lowball the theater system. And there's a pretty big $1 million delta there. What's the explanation for that?
So the explanation is based on, unlike in all the cases they cite, it's not just a lowball estimate where it's the insurer kind of rolling its eyes and throwing out a number. It's based on its own experts, and nobody questions that JS Held and the Dr. Hajam that were retained, timely retained, did all the work by Great Northern, were experts and gave what they thought was an appropriate estimate. It turned out that it was all about the scope of work was the ultimate difference, that there were things that JS Held that our experts, again, nobody questions that the experts, you know, weren't doing their best to give us their, and nobody questions that we relied on these experts, unlike in the bad faith cases like Blakely that they cite. But what was going on is the experts later realized and sort of developed during the appraisal process that there was just a misunderstanding about what was included in the contents of the house, what was in the theater, counted as part of the theater system versus what was part of the house itself. And had already been paid, and so additional amounts were added. And then there was a whole question about low voltage electrical system, which was $250,000. After the appraisal is commenced, we realize, or the evidence comes out, that we learned for the first time that that's supposed to be included.
It sounds like jury questions to me. The evaluation of these communications.
Because most of what I just said is not disputed. The only point that they rely on to say that there is a bad faith jury question is the delta between the two. And there's all kinds of case law that says a mere difference between the two isn't enough to establish bad faith. What I would absolutely concede, and because I think it's right, is that when you have a substantial delta, that might get you to discovery to figure out why does that delta exist? Is the insurer just folding its hands and refusing to do the kind of work we expect of insurers? And that happened here. They had full discovery, except for the one deposition that's completely irrelevant they complain about, but they had full discovery into what was going on. And when you lift the hood, scratch the surface on why this delta existed, it's perfectly clear. We had experts. We relied on the experts. Again, that's not disputed. The fact that they are expert is not disputed. The fact that they did, you know, their inspection work, they were trying to communicate with their expert about what the basis for their opinion was, and it all gets worked out.
Did you want to give Mr. Palmieri some time?
If no other questions on these issues, we would ask the court to affirm. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, John Palmieri appearing on the behalf of the broker defendants. Thank you, Judge Timkovich, for 2 minutes. Judge Moritz T. teed this up and presented the issue correctly in terms of the broker defendants. If they had not even exhausted the coverage limits at issue under the Chubb policy, nothing is left to prove causation, which is where Judge Moore went, that they failed to prove causation in this case. 3 points. First point is the language. The language of the policies, and the only two policies in the record, are the Chartis policy that predated the Chubb policy, and then the Great Northern or the Chubb policy that followed. The idea that you can argue, well, we have unlimited coverage, you have to show beyond speculation what coverage would have been available to them. And their argument is limited to the Chartis policy. The language is identical, usually rent to others. The language in terms of the ELE is substantially similar. Reasonable increase in living expenses to maintain household usual standard of living. If they do not, if Mr. Crum in this case, if plaintiff does not exhaust those limits, there's nothing in the Chartis policy that would have provided the causation, the link here to say, I would have gotten a different result under the Chartis policy. The conditions of coverage are identical. If you haven't exhausted the 15 days, then there's nothing there for the broker.
So the only big difference in the policies was the duration of the coverage, or I mean, is the extent of the coverage basically the same? But the other difference was that this was a vacation rental home, so there was a condition in the new policy that didn't exist in the old one.
No, Judge Eagle, there really wasn't. Not on the FRV. Usually rent to others is identical. It's 15 days. But if you haven't exhausted the 15 days, there's no causation.
And that's the only difference.
It's that and which. One policy says that and one policy says which. In terms of the ELE, there is some very slight differences, but it is, and you can compare them, we cite, reasonable increase in living expenses to maintain your household's usual standard of living. Same. Substantially similar. If I may just have 1 minute to wrap.
Go ahead and wrap up.
In terms of the causation, under the Gibbons versus Ludlow case, Judge Moore concluded that the burden is on them to present that evidence to prove a different result. They failed to meet that burden. Accordingly, they failed to present a crucial element, and therefore their claim fails. Be happy to address any other questions the panel may have. Otherwise, we ask that you affirm summary judgment. If it's affirmed for Great Northern, it follows for the broker defendants. But in any event, the broker defendants on their own have a causation basis, and we ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Is some rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Crum?
Mark Crum, on behalf of myself. Privileged to be before Your Honor. Thank you for the opportunity.
If I may start off, I'm going to answer each of your questions that I believe were not answered accurately, correctly, or truthfully under the record before you. Okay, let's first start off and let's lift up the hood as our counsel on the other side stated. I'll go backwards a little bit so maybe it's easier with the brokers first. The brokers are saying, well, wait, he didn't exhaust his coverage. First of all, the record supports factually that I asked for the coverage to be the same as Chartis. I wanted unlimited ELE and unlimited FRV. Why did Crum want unlimited ELE and FRV? Because Crum just built a $24 million house, okay, that he bought for $5 million and spent 5 years constructing it to be the world's greatest ski house. Okay, now what's the world's greatest ski house? That's making sure in Vail Valley, no house will come close, okay, to make it the house of choice of the upper echelon of wanting to rent houses. We have declarations and affidavits of people that would testify to support that. The first year I got the house, I told my brokers a month before I bought the house. Luckily, they did an internal document that was never provided us till discovery. I will rent this house, okay, at 30 days minimum a year. That is what I intend. I may not be able to do that because I may not find people that are willing to pay the rates that I need to justify the risk of renting a house that's a $20 million house with $2 million of art and millions of dollars of antiques. I know how blessed and lucky I am that that's the insurance I got. You know, if you want insurance for your Ferrari or your 911 that you're so blessed to have, and you want insurance to be able to drive those cars when they're in total, your insurance company that's saying we're going to give you that, but then gives you the Pinto for your honors to go from point A to the courthouse, you may be able to get there, but that's not what you paid for. That's not what your insurance company was obligated to pay. That goes to the ELA. Of course, the night at the Ritz that I stayed at seven nights at the Ritz in a one bedroom in the height of ski season at my preferred Marriott rate, which is hundreds of dollars less because I'm the highest status, then someone else would be able to stay there. That was $1,000 a night. That was seven nights in the middle of some of my demolition that took 90 days that was dangerous. Their own scientists, I have sites for all this. I have 29 seconds. I can give you a site for everything I'm saying if I'm permitted to go a minute or two longer. Their own scientists, not my scientists, Chubb scientists, January 8th, less than 2 weeks of the insured event. Get him, Crumb, out of the house, okay? Because they are now doing remediation. The insurance company, my insurance company, is instructing me to start with remediation. What does that mean? That means anybody going in and out of that house are wearing these white brackets.
Are we talking about the ELE? Here.
Well, we're talking about both, Your Honors.
Because I just wondered, Mr. Hacker said, well, they had to establish the usual days that you spent in Beaver Creek to establish what would be a reasonable substitute housing. Isn't that what happened?
That's what happened. Nobody brought up for the first 35 days usual vacation occupancy. That's the first thing with regard to ELE, because they want to show, hey, does this guy really use his house before we're going to let him have ELE, extra living expenses? I showed them within days, not months, within days, that I was at that Colorado residence 152 days for the past 2 years. It turned out to be 5 days more or 1 year. I gave them every airline ticket that I flew, every airline ticket, receipt, my credit card voucher, to and from where I flew, either Philadelphia, New York, LA, my practice.
Are you going back to bad faith now, or are you talking about ELE?
It's ELE, because they're saying I have to establish usual vacation occupancy.
Right.
It is also bad faith, Judge. If I can show them that I was at my house 257 days in 2 years and my insurance company protecting me, saying I only get 60 days, well, I disagree with that. But how could they not say I established my usual vacation occupancy immediately when I was at my house 257 days?
Well, you're over time. Why don't you go ahead and wrap up?
Okay. So first,
that means 10 seconds.
Okay. So first, just about how they were so concerned to get me into a hotel. Okay. And that's what they promised me. Well, I have 9 separate requests getting into hotels. All of them were denied. Or, as Your Honor asked, we're looking into it. But when the hotel request is 2 weeks ahead of time because I'm having business colleagues or family coming out and they never respond by that date, isn't that the effect of a denial?
All right. Thanks for your argument. Time's expired. The case is submitted, and we'll take a brief recess.